Welcome to Claudio's Speakeasy and Radio Theater. Your host, Claudio, Renaissance man and bard of WCOM, has opened the doors of the speakeasy once again on this beautiful spring morning.
Yes, it is beautiful out there.
Yeah, to invite you all in to find a seat. Get comfortable in the place where you're always welcome and can always expect the very best.
That's
good
right.
Morning,
good
Claudio.
Morning.
Poor soul who had to get up at what
4:30
hour this
in the morning to go open up the Carolina Theater.
Anyway, glad you're here.
Yes, me too. Had to worry for a bit.
Yes, you did. You're never here. I mean, you're always here when I get here, and you're never late. And today it was like almost 9:30 before you got here.
The entire time I was driving over, I figured, oh, God, she's worried.
Yes, she was worried, and she was very happy to see your car pull up. Anyway.
And we also have somebody that's actually been on my show before, but at this point it's been, God, a year and a half ago at least. Mm-hmm. And that's Sherry Monahan. You may remember her from Taste of Tombstone. She's a professional Western historian, particularly the early West. And she's also a genie fresh out of the bottle, also known as a genealogist. That's something she just got into. Give us a little taste of that. What branched you into that arena?
Well, it's, if I think about it right now, it's almost like a natural fit that has been a progression of time for me.
A lot of research anyway.
I do.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of research since the early 90s for my books. Mm-hmm. And I've dug into so many other people's pasts. It's easier to do your own genealogy in a way because you kind of already know, you've spoken to relatives, and you sort of have a little step ahead of everybody else. But when you reach into other people's pasts, you really just have a name, mm-hmm. maybe a place, and a date or two. And then you really have to start digging.
No doubt.
So I've been doing this now for over 15 years, and I thought, you know what, I need to earn a living. Who doesn't today? And I love researching. I mean, it's one of my passions. It's I tell people sometimes that I like to research almost as much as I like to write. So I thought, you know what, why not put something that I have been doing and it comes naturally to me and I love doing it and offer that to other people to help them find their past and their ancestors.
And just on a note about her passion for research, she wrote a book on the history of Apex and has just finished one, mm-hmm. the one I have before me, Images of America. It's about Carrie.
It is.
So,
it is my latest one. It just came out in January, so it's hot off the presses,
yes,
if you will.
It feels fresh.
So how did you go about getting all the photos that are in there? I mean, the photos are great.
The photos are wonderful. And the thing is when you do a book through Images of America, it's mm-hmm. a whole series. I'm sure people have seen them. They're all over for there's one on Carrboro mm-hmm. and there's one on Holly Springs. And, of course, I did the Apex one about a year and a half ago. And you kind of put out notices. I contacted genealogy societies, historical groups for those towns. Mm-hmm. Try to put out something in the local paper if the local paper is willing to help. Word of mouth kind of thing. And with the Carrie book, I reached out to the Friends of the Page Walker House, which is basically Carrie's historical society.
And what were you reaching out for?
Was there photographs.
Okay, that's
photographs.
Gotcha.
When the publisher says, hey, do you want to, you know, write a book about the history of Carrie with Arcadia Publishing is the publisher, it's immediate. You need pictures. Mm-hmm. You need 180 to 220 pictures. Uh-huh. That's the minimum.
So and looking at this book as well as the one you did on Apex, it's a situation where you can either look at the pictures or you can read between the pictures.
Exactly. Read between the lines,
both.
If you will.
Read between the lines. There we go.
So I basically reached out to the community, and the Carrie residents were so wonderful. So many of them, as happens in the past, is you get one family and they'll say, oh, well, have you talked to so-and-so? They've got a wonderful family collection. And I literally will go to their homes. They open up their personal family albums and they get to sit there with
Goodness.
Me and I get to look through them and I hear the family stories. And I was at one lady's house and her father had a huge amount of pictures. His family has been there. His family actually goes back to Yates Mill Pond.
Wow.
And that's how long they've been in the area. And he had recently turned over all of his photos to his daughter, Carla, who is now the family history taker. And so she spent hours with me going over their family history. I was there so long, she made me lunch. Sweet is that?
I love the idea of having their family pictures in a book.
No doubt.
I mean, that's great.
Yeah, but the thing is that Carla's father, he was so worried that he said, you make sure that you don't put all my pictures in there. I want this to be about the other people in Carrie. I don't want to be the only one taking up all the space. And I thought that was so sweet. I mean, that he didn't want to be all about him.
Yes. But
wonderful, wonderful people that I met. So many different people that offered photos and history.
Did you record these events or are you just remembering them?
Just remembering them. And well, actually, I sat down and I had my little netbook with me and I interviewed them and I kept a bunch of notes, which are a lot of those are incorporated in the book.
So. It's a lot easier with technology now.
It is. And I actually go there and scan their photos so they never, you know, have to leave them with me. Although there was one man who actually lives in Chapel Hill. I should have thought to tell him to listen this morning. I forgot. And he gave me a bunch of photos. And he actually gave me a box of photos and yearbooks from the 1920s. They were his mother's. And I was terrified that something was going to happen to these. Yeah. I prayed I didn't get in a car accident. I prayed my house didn't burn down.
Just for the photos.
I was like, please don't let anything happen. To his precious memories that he has entrusted to me.
That's a pretty big deal, yeah.
And I was worried from the moment I had them until the moment I handed them back to him.
And could you tell what you had? I mean, for your material?
Oh, yeah. He had some wonderful things in there. His mother was a longtime, Mrs. Adams was a longtime school teacher for the Cary schools. I mean, for forever. Okay. So, and her yearbooks were in there, and his father was... oh, good Lord, what did they call him? A deputy marshal, I think. Hmm. I mean, he had been in Cary history, deep in Cary history as well. So just some wonderful stories that you'll read in the book. So it was just a lot of fun.
Incredible. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it amazes me that, I mean, since last I've seen you, you've put out two more books at least. Or might be three.
Just the Cary? Just this one?
No, Apex 2.
Well, Apex. Oh, I
didn't see it before then. We never did manage to connect.
We never did.
We didn't do the Apex Seafarers thing that we were planning on.
And all right. Well, then so Apex and Cary. How's that?
There we go.
So where do people find the book if they want it?
It's all over the place.
Okay.
Most Walgreens and Cary.
All right.
Oddly enough, I've done a couple book signings at a Walgreens. It's the most interesting book signings I've ever done.
You give them your website so they don't know how to
pursue you. It's very easy. It's my name, SherryMonahan.com.
Good. That's MonaHan.com.
Yeah. Sherry with a Y. And I'm actually,
two R's and a Y.
Just like the very delicious drink.
Now that we've totally confused you.
That's how I know if people actually drink or not. I'll say to them, oh, how do you spell your name? Sherry, just like the wine. And if they go, oh, okay, got it. Or I know they drink it. If they go, what? Oh, okay.
With me, it was cooking Sherry, thank you.
Cooking Sherry. You can come out and see me this weekend. I will be at the Barnes & Noble at the Streets at South Point from 1 to 3, and I will sign your book for you.
When is the, what day?
Saturday.
That's the day I'm doing my thing.
Yeah, the 26th.
Oh.
Is it the 26th?
Yeah,
it is the 26th. I think it's the 26th from 1 to 3.
I've got an art exhibit at Belk, of all places. Yes.
So we can't come and see each other, but...
No.
You all come to one and then come to the other. And we'll
that's it.
So this is the Belk in at South
Point? Sanford.
In Sanford, okay.
Yeah,
all right.
I'm doing an art exhibit with the Temple Theater as my charity fundraiser.
Right, that's great.
So percentage of my sales. And the Belk is also selling $5 tickets to be part of the 30% discount that comes up on April 16th, which is their big charity event. And all of those $5 tickets go directly to Temple Theater. So Belk doesn't keep any of it. That's Belk's way of paying the charity.
Great.
So they should do quite well.
Yes. Well, it's a great theater.
I feel like the homeboy needs to do something for the local community theater, and Peggy feels the same way, so
yes,
I did.
Yes.
I think it's great.
Yeah. It was just, it happened because of a friend that insisted on getting my art out. And he said, look, have you thought about Belk? I said, no, I don't think about these places. Come on. And so he goes, and he says, I've spoken to the manager. You guys need to meet person to person. And I go over there to meet this guy. I'm going to make this story very short. I didn't mean to butt in on Sherry's time here. And I go over there, and I'm about to shake hands with this guy, and we both look at each other and we go, I know you.
Hmm.
And it turns out 30 years ago, this guy named Graham Spencer, who is the district manager for Belk at Sanford, was the food and beverage manager at the Ramada Inn by Crabtree in Raleigh, where I was the executive chef.
Oh, how funny.
So
you just never know.
He looks at me, he goes, well, you know, I was actually going to give you a sob story that we really, you know, Belk really can't do this. But since it's you, we're going to have to find a way in through the window. So,
oh, very cool.
That's great.
Yes.
See, it's
so my karma's catching up with me.
It is.
It's good to leave
in
happy
a good
trails
way.
Behind you.
Right, right. So tell us about this genealogy.
Wow.
Who let you out of the bottle?
Who let me out of the bottle? I'm sure there's lots of people asking that question.
With me, it's who gave you the bottle.
With me, it's where is my bottle? Irish whiskey, that is.
Yes, there we go. I can handle that.
Oh, the Monaghan is coming out.
It is.
Yes.
It is. I'd be going to Ireland in May as well.
Yeah, bugger.
Are you going to be researching over there?
It's mostly a family vacation, and my husband hates to hear me say this, but I am going to do a little research. And yeah, I know you might be listening, so deal with it.
Well, the White Cliffs of Dover are very steep. Just bear that in mind.
Yes, that's true. Well, I've been working on a book. It was called The Secret Lives of Evelyn, but we've changed it to The Aristocratic Ranch
Wife. She goes over?
She lived in England, but her third husband was from Ireland. And apparently, I have never been able to find what happened to him after she passed away in the 1930s. Well, I found a little nugget, and I believe he is buried in one of the churches in downtown Dublin, which is where we're going to be the last 2 days.
Well, let's do a quick loop here, because the audience out there is probably wondering what just
the
smoked.
What the heck is Evelyn?
Yes. So, let's go all the way back to Taste of Tombstone and just explain a little bit of the history of that and then how you came upon this character, Evelyn, that's actually a real person.
Okay. So we'll backpedal.
Yes, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
This was her I want to say your first book, right?
It was my first.
A Taste of Tombstone, where she actually went back, she explored the West, and one of her concerns was that back in the old days in the West, that they just ate slop for food, and she was, and this sort of...
She didn't say slop. She said chili.
Chuck wagon grub.
When I think of a wagon bouncing up and down behind a bunch of cows, I'm thinking slop.
I'm sure that the cooks back then would not have been happy to hear you say that.
No, I'm sure.
The cowhands probably would have said slop sometimes.
But I can say it as one, so that
you can.
Minimizes me a little bit. It diminishes me, not them. There we go.
Oh, okay. I wanted to find out. I had gone to Tombstone on vacation back in the mid to late 90s. Wanted to know what they ate, because I love food. I am a home cook, self-taught chef, I guess, if you will. I love to play in the kitchen. And so I thought...
Yes, and from what she's told me, she's quite good.
Thank you.
No, I mean, you can tell in conversation whether somebody actually knows how to put something together
about,
or whether
right.
they're just theorizing. And she's definitely been at the table with it.
At the table, behind the table.
She's really skinny, folks. I mean, you're figuring now. You've got somebody that's very large, but she's a skinny young woman.
Well, look at this energy that she's putting into the microphone. That's where it goes.
That's
well,
right.
It's all about, I preach. I actually have another website called DeliciousHealthyFood.com. And I keep recipes, and it's kind of outdated right now. I've been busy with my writing. But I like to preach that everything that you eat needs just to be healthy, and everything in moderation. And that's my thing, is that I can have butter, I can have cream sauce, but I can't have it every single meal. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where I go with my food. So that's, and I work out every, you know, at the gym, but it really is it's a mindset of what you eat and how much you eat. And I don't have anything prepackaged. You know, in my house, I have a pantry, but it's just got the basics. I cook from scratch every meal.
Good
so, you know, if I can't pronounce it, it doesn't go in my body.
Yes.
That's
my theory. I like that.
Anyway, we trailed from Tombstone, but
Taste of Tombstone, please.
Tombstone of back to food, of course.
Yes.
And I really just wanted to know what they ate. And I love to cook, as I said. So I started doing a little digging, and I found out, surprised, as probably everyone was, wow, they weren't eating chuck wagon chili and steaks. They were eating classic French food. But then I realized is that this was the Victorian era, and the people that were living in Tombstone weren't cowboys. They were Westerners or Easterners, and they were from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you didn't leave your thoughts and your morals and your recipe books behind when you left New York or England to go west. You took all that with you. You're still the same person.
They were the owners of the mines.
Well, some of them were. And a lot of them were workers, though.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people would follow the mining circuit. So they would go to San Francisco for the gold rush.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that played out, then they would go to the next mining camp and the next and the next.
It's funny because, if I may interrupt for a moment, the vision that we have of the West, especially from cinema, is that the Englishman or the Frenchman or the foreigner, so to speak, of which I am one, they were the rare characters, because you'll see, like, Richard Harris, you know, the isolated character, whereas they were actually in the majority.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and they were. Those were the majority of people. I mean, you had people from the East Coast, you had people from Europe, and they dressed in suits. They dressed in fancy Victorian dresses. And a lot of people, I always preach that I write about the Victorian West, because I blend the two. People think of the Western expansion as one, and they think of the Victorian era as two.
Right,
in essence, they happened at the exact same time. So you think about people going west, they were Victorians. So, you know, they had the hats,
suits. Because you think of them as being all farmhands or something.
And wearing the chaps and the cowboy hats and the spurs.
And the gingham skirts.
Yeah. The movie Tombstone does a great job of portraying what
The most recent one.
With Val Kilmer and most recent from the 90s. But, you know, yes. But that movie, they do a great job with costuming and what the saloons and the restaurants look like. That's what Tombstone and the West look like. Now, you will have places that were remote towns in Nebraska and Kansas where, yeah, they were dressed a little less. You know, the guys just had on their basic clothes. The women had a basic prairie dress. They didn't get all fancied up.
Deadwood comes to mind.
Deadwood. Deadwood was a very wealthy mining town. When it started out, it was, you know, kind of rough and tumble, but it eventually turned into what Tombstone would have looked like, again, with money, with the fancy clothes, with the restaurants. And so it really just depends on, did you have money in the West?
And you don't even, I don't even think of the West as having a restaurant in those days. They had saloons. You
know? Saloons, brothels, and then there was something to eat.
Exactly, exactly.
And there were dance halls.
And
they didn't dance there. But that's how I got interested in Taste of Tombstone, was the food. Yeah.
And in the book, from what we said a little earlier, is you've got recipes?
There are. The book is half history, half recipes. And the recipes, there's about 140 of them. And they are taken directly from the menus that appeared in the local Tombstone newspapers from the 1880s. So you are, I took the recipes that are in the book, are from old books from the 1800s. And so they are very typical of what they would have had in Tombstone. Veal. I mean, they had veal. I'm trying to think. They had chicken fricassee. They had salmon a la Parisienne. It got to one point in 1880, the newspapers were printing the menus in French. And one of the newspaper reporters came out and said, "Hallelujah, the Grand Hotel has finally come to their senses and started printing the menus in English." That's how trendy French food was. They wrote it in French, but most of the population didn't speak French.
That's fascinating.
Didn't know what
that's
it was.
But I guarantee you they knew what it was on the menu because that's what they were accustomed to.
And it's how the waiter or the waitress earned their tips. They could explain it.
They could explain it to them, Lucy. Yes.
That's right.
So if people wanted that book today, they would just go Google it and find out where it might be.
They can, or they can go to my website and they can order it from me and I can sign it for them.
All right.
Very quickly, just want to remind everybody, you're listening to Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater here on WCOM 103.5 FM. And I'm doing this because I've got to announce my sponsor, the Historic Carolina Theater. They've got the Durham Savoyards performing Princess Ida this week. And then toward the end of the month, at the end of the month, I think 31st, one of my favorite people on this earth, Judy Collins, shows up, and I'm hoping to host and stage manage her. And it'll be the second time. We really connected well the first, so I'm hoping I'm on that call. Hint, hint, anyone listening? Anyway, so I just wanted to give a shout-out to the Historic Carolina Theater of Durham, our sponsor, underwriter here for Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater. Back to Sherry Monahan.
Okay.
And Audrey. And now Sherry doesn't know what to say.
Ta-da!
Well, we've gone through a taste of Tombstone. Obviously, we haven't yet taken a trip to Apex and or Kerry. And then we're going into the genie bottle with genealogy.
Well, where would you like to go first?
I'll let
you be the navigator.
Let's go to the genealogy and then we'll bounce back and forth.
Okay.
I wanted to just jump in there when you said you were going to be in Ireland and then you said you were only going to be there for 2 days. And I figured, well...
That is awfully short.
No. Well, Dublin for two days.
Okay.
Yeah, no, we're going to be there for 9 days. This is my third trip to Ireland and it's a wonderful place. And the food there is awesome, of course.
So what's bringing this about?
My husband and my father-in-law passed away last year. My mother-in-law has wanted to go back to Ireland ever since we went the last time, because we went with my in-laws the two times before. And she was feeling kind of down, so we decided that, you know, we'd take her to Ireland. And my niece, who we spend a week with this in the summer, she's 21 now, 22, but she's like our daughter. You know, if we had one, she'd be ours. I always say she's a blend of both of us. So the four of us decided we'd go to Ireland. And then my husband's younger brother said, "Oh, this sounds like a family trip, and I'm never going to get to go to Ireland. Ireland, so I want to go." There's five of us
that's
going.
Fantastic.
So we're heading to the northwest part of Ireland, County Donegal, for the majority of our trip because there's so many wonderful things to do
Sure.
And then we're going back to Dublin for 2 days to do the museums and Trinity College and St. Patrick's Cathedral and all the wonderful things.
I imagine she's not going to be still for a moment.
No. And definitely have to hit the Guinness and the Jameson place.
Oh, God, yes. Have a half and half for me.
I was thinking about that in regards to genealogy because there were so many Irish that came over here. And my husband was Irish. His family, well, he was born here, but his family was, at least his father's side, was born in Ireland. And I've been able in the past to find where some other of my ancestors came over from Norway, you know, the Ellis Island ship manifests and so on and so forth. And on my mother's side, found New York City census records for my father-in-law, I guess, whatever, whoever it is. My father's father, my grandfather. I'm not with it this morning. Anyway.
I can see the wheels turning, but they're rolling backwards.
Exactly. But I can't find anything that documents my husband's family coming over from Ireland on his father's side. Hmm. I can't find, it's not that I can't find Leydens, I can find 17 zillion.
We have the detective in the room.
There are 17 zillion Leydens that came over here.
Oh, God, no doubt.
Yeah.
So it's, while I have, information from here, I can't.
What year did they come over, or what time period?
Yeah,
any idea?
Let's see. I would guess it would be 1900, around 1900.
So they came over much later than
The famine.
Than the famine did.
Yeah.
That should make it easier, almost easier to find. I mean, there's going to be a more volume of people that would have come over. The trick is name spellings.
Right.
And not just that it was changed. I mean, so many people have the myth that, oh, my family's name was changed. And a lot of that happened.
Right.
But a lot of times, and you have to keep in mind, most of the records that you're searching online today, which are wonderful, you have to keep in mind that those records have been transcribed by a human being. And when you're looking at 19th century handwriting and early 1900 handwriting, it's quite different from what we use today.
Mm-hmm.
So what I can't tell you that how many times I've been researching my Evelyn book that I know how to spell their name, and I know they were on this ship manifest.
And we are coming back to Evelyn eventually,
which is how we started this whole thing.
We're on the way there.
But what I've learned is I knew that she had kept some letters, and they were published in a book in 1886. So she documented the day, the name of the ship, and where it left from. So I knew what date and the name of the ship that they came over on.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew they were on the manifest. Well, when I typed in the name into Ancestry.com, it didn't come up.
Right.
When I typed in Castle Garden, and what people should know, too, is that Ellis Island records are only more current from 1892 past. I believe it's 1892 forward. So if your relatives came over before 1892, you need to go to Castle Garden, because that was the immigration port where people came in, not Ellis Island. So that's
maybe
a key. And those are both free. Those are both free websites that you can search. CastleGarden.org, I believe.
Interesting.
Exactly the way you would expect Castle and Garden.
It is.
Now, enlighten us on how you came across this character, Evelyn, while you were doing Taste of Tombstone.
Well, let me finish my this genealogy thing, and then we'll go to that.
Yes.
But I knew she was on this ship. So I went through each. There were 22 pages of the ship's manifest for that particular day, and I looked through every single one. And what I found was that their last name was Hertzlet, H-E-R-T-S-L-E-T. When I found their information, I saw where you could easily misunderstand the handwriting. And so going through some back doors with my research, I found that the person who had transcribed their name had put it as Herkler, H-E-R-K-L-E-R, not anywhere close to what you would think to search for.
Right.
But that just goes to show you, when you're doing genealogy research, how far off you could type in Hertzlet all day long and never find them.
Right.
So sometimes it's not just a matter of typing in a name and not getting a hit going, okay, they weren't there. Sometimes you actually need to go through, read the documents, and sometimes you're looking at census pages. But if you know they were in a certain county or in a certain town, I've done that. I have looked through 40 pages of census for a name. When I was researching the Carrie book, I was trying to do some genealogy, and I typed the name, I couldn't find anything. I knew they were there. Mm-hmm. Again, I looked through every page of the census and found it, and they had transcribed it wrong. So transcription is a huge factor when you're trying to do research. Yeah. So don't get discouraged if you haven't found them. They're there. It's just a matter of how to find them.
Forget about it. I'm not even going into that pond.
I've got another story that I guess it's all right to, it's very brief, that to tell now, because all the parties are no longer with us on the planet. But I did have an illegal immigrant.
Ooh, how exciting.
And, one of my aunts, her husband, my uncle, jumped ship here.
Ooh.
On a ship from Sweden.
Hmm.
And he jumped ship in the Brooklyn Navy Yard or wherever it was they landed the ship. And that was it. He was never documented.
Wow, that's hard.
Lived his whole life here. But that was way back.
Way back when.
I mean, it's...
They were probably not as thorough. I think he died in the 1950s or something.
Yeah.
Well, I think the key to doing genealogy research, as I like to say, is it's important to know what you're looking for, but it's equally as important to know where to look.
Right,
and how
right.
to look, you know,
absolutely.
What, you know,
I'm look
what you need
Castle
to do.
Garden up anyway.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely, it's a free site. And now we will segue into Evelyn.
I want to know more about Evelyn.
Evelyn.
Yes.
Okay. Evelyn was a...
And how she tied in with Taste of Tombstone?
Not at all.
Well, how on earth did we get that started?
Well, in a roundabout way, I guess.
Maybe
you
I'm
could
thinking
say,
because you and I spoke of her afterwards.
When we were doing the Taste of Tombstone interview, I think we ended up talking about
it. It was after
Evelyn.
The interview. It was when we were having coffee.
Oh, maybe. That's
across the street
was.
Later. Okay. That's when Evelyn came up.
But Evelyn was, after I had done Taste of Tombstone and a couple of my other books, I wanted to do a book about the Victorian women in the West and how they adapted their lifestyles to living in the West. And in doing my research, there's a bunch of journals that you'll find either online, and that women were notorious back in that time period, especially they were on the Oregon Trail, the Overland Trail, of documenting their journeys, which is wonderful because we can really get a peek into what people's lives were like back then, the hardships they endured, the roundabouts that they did. And so what I did was I started looking into these women, and I found five. Of those five, Evelyn was one of them. So I pitched the idea to the publisher about, you know, if someone talks about, you know, they rode the horse into town or they rode a buggy, you know, what kind of clothing would they have worn? How would they have handled it? You know, kind of an etiquette versus a lifestyle thing. Well, they thought it was too broad of a subject. So I put it aside for a while. Then for some reason, Evelyn just kept saying, pick me up, pick me up. Pick me up. So I went back to Evelyn.
They thought it was too broad of a subject, and you thought, no, this broad is a subject.
Exactly. Damn right.
Okay.
Oh, come on. Let me get my 2 cents in.
Should I give you some change?
Please. Keep it in your pocket.
We're not letting him get away with anything this morning.
No right. way. So I started to do more research on Evelyn. And the thing is with the journal that I mentioned earlier, she kept 18 months worth of personal letters that she had sent back home because she was from England and they moved to Lake County, California in 1885. Well, she was so homesick and felt so isolated, she constantly wrote letters back home telling about their life here. And in 1886, an English publisher published those letters. However, they're only published under EMH.
Interesting.
The home, it says, the title, actually the formal title is Extracted from the Home Correspondence of EMH, Ranch Life in California. And that's how it was published. And in the book, the woman who is the main person is Evelyn. Her husband is George. And then there's a lot of times where she'll just reference people's initials. But then there's other times where she talks about real life people, because I was doing, you know, my research. I wanted to know who they were, and I would Google these names, and some were real, some I couldn't find anywhere. Mostly they were all initials. And it got me to thinking, all right, well, who is EMH? Then I did some more research, and the Library of Congress has a large collection of information online, and her book is in there. Well, there's a little note from the Library of Congress that says this book was attributed to Evelyn Herzlet in a 1928 English sale catalog. So apparently in 1928 in England, a catalog advertising this book attributed the last name of Herzlet to Evelyn, because nowhere in her letters does it give a last name. So it was a mystery for me to try to solve. Well, the more digging I did and more genealogy I did, I ended up finding out that her name is not Evelyn, that her name is Ethel. Her husband's name is not George, it's Gerald. All of these were aliases.
My goodness.
And so now the speculation between me and my publisher is, okay, how do we handle this? I always thought that it was, she was hiding her identity because his father was very high up in the English government. Her father was a well-known English musician. You know, did they not want to have people know that they were living this lifestyle in California? So did they keep it all hush-hush? Did they not want the neighbors to know they were writing about them, which is why they used initials and they used fake names? My publisher seems to think maybe, and I have looked into this, the same publisher did another book with a woman's initials of IH. And it was simply they didn't want the neighbors to know. Now, it wasn't a common trend of newspapers or of magazines or publishers back then to publish simply initials. I thought maybe it was a woman thing. You know, women couldn't have their name as publishers. But then, you know, you had Willa Cather and a bunch of other women. So it wasn't that. So it's sort of like this, all right, why? Why were there initials? But beyond why were the initials, the interesting story is, here's this English woman, very high aristocratic woman, very social. Her parents, I think, had a staff of seven servants in the census listed. So I knew she came from money. Where they lived, I saw that. I was in London last year in England. I went to the house where she lived, very prestigious neighborhood, very beautiful. Her father was one of the musicians at the Crystal Palace, which Prince William, Prince Albert, I'm sorry, Prince William, Prince Albert founded back in the early 1800s.
The one in the can.
The one in the can, exactly. So. He was married to Queen Victoria.
Yes.
And so, sorry, I hit the mic with my chin. So
trying a new drum roll here.
So I ended up doing research about her lifestyle, and she was so wealthy that her mother was terrified that she was going to starve when they came to America. So she sent her into her English kitchen for the servants to teach her how to bake bread and roast meat. So this is the level of her sophistication. Well, her husband, who she married very quickly, a lot of interesting circumstances around all that, he had lost a ton of money in the Egyptian bond market, which every Englishman of any salt back then was invested in. Mm. And after the fall of Khartoum, lost hundreds of thousands of dollars. So they decided, he and his two other stockbroker brothers decided that they were going to go west to California and make it rich in America.
Hmm. Okay.
They decided to become ranchers. Now, these are stockbrokers. They go all the way to California and become ranchers. Why on earth? I have no idea. I think a lot of people in Europe thought that gold and money was just lying about in the West, and it was just there for the taking. And then when they got here, they were stunned to learn that, wow, they settled in Lake County, California. The soil was rocky. The climate wasn't what they expected. It was beautiful countryside, but they had no clue what they were doing. They were actually the laughingstock of the community. Oh, no. Luckily for them, they were living in an English community where it was very sophisticated. She took all of her silver and her china, and they had linens, tablecloths. Now, you're living out west, but this woman did not leave her Victorian life behind. But in 18 months, you see a total transformation. And so her story is just so fascinating to me, as I alluded to you earlier, mm-hmm. is that she was just a woman looking for happiness. And everything that she did in her life was almost a roadblock that she put there and prevented her happiness. She married three times. I mean, in her life, last marriage, she got married at age 74. And her husband,
romantic to the end.
Well, there was a rumor in some of the newspapers that she married Gerald, but she was engaged or was committed to another man
at the same time
when she met Gerald. Apparently, he saw her in the movie Romeo or the play Romeo and Juliet, and he just was smitten with her, and he wooed her and took her away from this other nobleman. And
so she acted on the stage.
Yes, she did. And she acted on the stage here after they failed miserably in Lake County, California. They decided that they were going to be theater people. So in 1898, they launched a theater career and went all up and down the whole East Coast or West Coast of California and Oregon.
And which husband was with?
This was her first husband.
Was this before she moved to Utah and started a colony?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
This is fascinating.
But then they got divorced. I'm sorry, 1892, they started their,
that's
their,
right. Get it right.
Their acting tour. Stop. 1898, they had a scandalous divorce that made the New York Times. That's how big this was. Oh, yeah. She ended up divorcing him, married her first cousin, was married to him for 30-some years.
One of the mountain weddings.
From 30-some years, and then ended up, he died, and then he died. They had moved back to England by this time.
Are we sure she didn't kill him?
You never know. Well, why wouldn't she kill him? She was with him for 30-some years, you know?
Yeah. Oh, well, never mind.
Why not? I don't know if that was actually a marriage of love or just a marriage of companionship. Mm-hmm. Because
in those days, a lot happened for companionship.
It did.
Remember
they were
Isaac Dinesen,
and
same sort of thing out of Africa.
There was just a lot of that. Yeah. And I just think maybe she just was by herself, and she apparently was having a fling with that cousin and his two brothers, according to the husband's divorce papers.
When is this book coming out? I want to read it.
Yes.
This sounds fascinating.
Oh, with any luck, you know, a year. That's how long it takes to publish a book. I've been trying to get it done with my one publisher out in Texas.
Well, how far along are you at this point?
I'm done.
What?
I just need the publisher to give me the okay, and so I'm hoping to speak with someone this week. They want me to rewrite the way I did it, so which isn't a big deal. I mean, there's always room for improvement on the first time you put out, you know, a manuscript to a publisher. Mm-hmm. I've been in the business long enough to know that that's not.
So you're not necessarily in solid form yet.
No, it's I'm finished with it, mm-hmm. But I know they want me to rework the way it's laid out, and I'm okay with that. So I am going to be working on that in the midst of all of my other things that I do. But
right.
But hopefully it'll be out soon. Uh-huh. So it's just a matter of time. But yeah, everybody hears that and they go, oh, I want that. I want to read that book.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, I know. I want you to read it.
Now let's bounce over to another aspect of your life.
I will.
As far as the West thing goes, you also do some stuff for cable television. Give us the scoop on that. I know
the History Channel.
Yes. Every once in a while,
really?
I get an email from some part of the country.
I've done five shows on the History Channel. Mm-hmm. My first one was called Investigating History. It was about Wyatt Earp.
And I wondered why you look familiar. That's one of my favorite shows.
With Bill Curtis. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
That was one of my favorite, my first. That was my first.
So you did one of the ones that you were out there with, they were doing mining or looking for something?
That was the Wild West Tech series.
You had a good memory.
Yeah.
That was the Wild West Tech series. I did one on mining. And we were in Virginia City, Nevada is where we filmed that. And then we did one on gambling tech, and that was also filmed in Virginia City. I did...
So we've got a TV star here.
No, yes, you do.
You just recognized me as soon as I walked
TV
in, I know.
TV star on radio. Take a good look.
Well, he did look familiar, but I've lived here long enough so everybody looks familiar. But,
yeah.
And I'm a sailor on a horseback, so...
That's right. I did the Lost Worlds show. They had a whole series, a two-year series, I believe, that ran, and I did... It was called Sin City of the West, and it was about Deadwood. I was there on location for 4 days. I had such a blast on that show. The only thing was is that it was in June. And I checked the weather, and it was supposed to be mid-60s, 70s, with the lows at 40s at night.
Comfortable.
It's like, okay, that's not too bad. So I picked out. Now, the producer told me, you have to wear the same outfit every day for continuity, because you can't change clothes every day because we're going to be filming over a four-day period, but it has to look like we filmed you in one day.
Right.
So, you gotta be kidding me. So I went to the store and I bought two pairs of the same jeans and two tops exactly the same. So at least could change and wash while I was there. So, and I looked at the weather. I said, okay, I just need a light windbreaker. So I had like a black denim jacket I took with me. I got there the first day and they were under a tornado warning. And the next day we were supposed to shoot, it was going to snow.
Oh, good grief.
And let's just say I didn't have the right clothing, but I couldn't do anything about it. I had what I had, so I had to wear the clothes I had.
How'd you folks stay warm?
Oh, I nearly froze to death. In between takes, the camera guy gave me his gloves, the producer gave me his jacket, you know, the director gave me something else. It was just funny, and it got to, we were filming one location where the wind had swept down, and it was so frigid that my fingers turned blue.
Jeepers.
Oh, my goodness.
And everybody has got my hands between theirs, rubbing them, you know, to make me warm. By the end of the shoot, it was 80 degrees, and I was sunburned.
Oh, my goodness.
That's how extreme it was. Within 4 days. And the camera guy was so funny because he kept saying to me, if you don't stop changing color, we're going to have a problem. Your clothes are the same, but your face is getting more red every day.
Great.
What's the altitude there?
I honestly don't know, but it is pretty high up.
Yeah.
It's pretty high up.
Got to be.
But it was just amazing. It was just like the whole swing of the weather thing.
That's incredible.
And then my last show that I did was called Cowboys and Outlaws, and it was about Wyatt Earp. And that was out 2 years ago, and I won a Wrangler Award for my performance in that.
All right. What were you doing?
I was acting.
Well, of course.
That's fantastic.
On what?
Well, I was in. We went to film on location outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico. And the movie set that we used was the Cheyenne Social Club with Jimmy Stewart.
I love that movie.
That was the set was built for that movie. So here I am in this great historic movie setting and we're filming. And again, there's no heat or air conditioning and it's in July, but I'm in, or it was in March,
but it gets
I think.
Cold
it
at
was
night.
Freezing in there. So, you know, I'm shivering and I have to do, this was a really cool, it was an interactive history show. Normally they just sit and they interview you and you talk. This one, I was standing in a saloon and they did historical takes and then they were interviewing me and I had a bartender actor and he was behind the bar and I was telling people about the drinks that they drank back in the day because everybody thinks you just had a shot of whiskey, but in fact, they were drinking very fancy saloon drinks. And so they were having me explain what these were and explaining what rot gut was. Well, rot gut was a form of knockoff whiskey. Either you were in a remote place and you couldn't get your whiskey supply, but you had customers who wanted it, or you were too damn cheap to offer real whiskey, so you made it up. And rot gut is moonshine, plug tobacco
just
juice,
say moonshine,
and cane sugar, burnt cane sugar.
Plug tobacco juice.
Yeah. And what they would do is they would put all that concoction together in a big jug and let it sit for a few days till it got the right color and
that
a little
the
bite
caramel
to
color,
it.
Yeah.
And then they'd strain it into whiskey bottles.
It does sound like rot gut.
It was. And sometimes they were pretty unscrupulous and they used kerosene, which
that,
obviously could cause
and
serious
And that tobacco
problems.
Would actually hit you in the gut.
Well, it did because I had to drink that.
That's
I had
right.
to drink
you told
that
me
for
that.
The show. And we did three takes. Not that because I was bad at what I did, but they do different camera angles. So you can't.
You have had something that looked like that?
No, they wanted to get the effects of what my face looked like when I actually tasted it. After that, I showed everybody how to make a champagne flip, which was a very popular drink back in the day. And champagne flip is, of course, champagne, powdered sugar, and a raw egg. I had to drink that three times on top of the plug tobacco juice.
I sure was a very happy accident.
Let's just say I wasn't feeling too well later that day in my belly.
She went to some place and lay an egg, yeah.
Well, that's cute. But my director for that show, it was 8:30 in the morning on a Sunday, and I'm slamming back rot gut and champagne flips.
That's amazing.
And on an empty stomach, might I add. And
it's very effective that way.
It was cold. My hands were shaking because I was nervous, and it was cold. So I'm there. I'm holding the drink with two hands up to my mouth. I'm like, oh, God, this is going to look ridiculous.
This is in the scene?
This is in the scene. And I'm holding it up, and I'm shaking, and I'm shaking, and I'm nervous. And then about 2 hours later, we did the gambling scene where I was doing Pharaoh. I was teaching people how to play the game of Pharaoh, which was the popular game. And the director...
She's the female Laurence Olivier, yeah.
Yeah. And the director says to me, oh, you're so much more relaxed for this segment. I said, I'm drunk. What do you think?
No inhibitions here, thank you.
When is somebody going to write your story?
Yeah, oh, Lord. That's the idea.
No way. It's yet to be told. It's not finished. Well, it's a work in progress.
Yes.
Right?
It'll be discovered with all the somewhere in mingled in all the stories she tells.
All right. Were we supposed to talk about something?
We were supposed to talk about the book that you have out now.
Oh, Carrie.
We've gotten the fact that Evelyn is already written, so we'll get back to her when she appears. But the book you're promoting now, what do you want to say about that?
Carrie, it's interesting. There was a lot of interesting stuff about the Carrie history that I did not know. Some people will be familiar with the Bradford's Ordinary. It's funny, there is a restaurant in Cary now called the 1750 Ordinary, and that is named after a settlement that appeared in Cary in 1750.
And what's this Bradford's Ordinary?
Bradford's Ordinary was a way stop where people could rest their horses, get a quick meal in between Raleigh and the western part of the state. And it was there in 1750, and as far as I could do my research, it was still on the maps in 1808. It sat where the current town hall sits today.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
Mm-hmm. And so that is the earliest settlement of Cary, and that sort of surprised me. I didn't realize that Cary, not Cary proper, but the area of Cary was settled that early. And then in 1858, and then 1854, Frank Allison Page settled and bought a bunch of land in the area and decided he was going to farm it. And he started a lumber mill and he built a hotel. Once he knew the railroad was coming, so he built a hotel right in front of the railroad, which is right where the Page Walker House, which is the original hotel.
Right.
And so I thought that was kind of interesting too. What's another tidbit? Oh, Carrie, speaking of drinking, you'd think I have a problem, but just keep coming back to this.
It's only water in the bottle here.
No problem.
It's really only water.
While she's thinking about that, I just want to say you're listening to Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater. We have the author, Sherry Monahan, to my left, and of course, Audrey Layden to my right, and this is the Speakeasy, so here we go.
There Cheers. He is, stuck in the middle.
Stuck in the middle.
Not a bad place to be. So back to Carrie and something you were stuck in.
What?
Never mind. The drink.
Thank you.
Something about drinking.
I was like, what is he talking about? Something about drinking. Who's been drinking it? What's in your mug?
Right.
I don't know. You can't see through his.
That's right.
I know. It's
it is.
Silver container. I'm not really sure. The one thing that was interesting is Cary was named after an Ohio prohibitionist named Samuel Fenton Cary. That's how it got its name. So I always say that Cary was destined to be connected with Yankees.
Prohibitionist, did you say?
Prohibitionist.
Interesting.
So Cary was founded under a dry charter.
I'm beginning to like
Cary. So you could not drink in Cary. Uh-huh. And then in the 1960s, I haven't really pinned down a date, I believe 64, 65, Cary decided to repeal the dry charter and allow drinking.
Ah, good.
Well, the state attorney general's office notified Cary, well, that is just wonderful that y'all are with the program and are going to allow drinking, but you could have been drinking since 1933 when Wake County repealed it.
Uh-huh. I was actually in one of the people in the race when they passed liquor by the drink.
Oh.
For the Hilton Hotel on Hillsborough Street.
Wow.
So I'm part of the history.
I see that. Another interesting fact that I like to tell is that in 1900, Cary had a female postmaster.
Uh-huh.
Her name was Lucy Revis, and her brother was her postal clerk.
Uh-huh.
So I thought that was kind of neat. What else have I learned? Oh, one thing that is not in the book, but I share at my talks that I give, is how everybody knows that Cary is an acronym for... containment area of relocated Yankees or congested area of relocated Yankees. That's what it stands for today.
I didn't know
now
that.
We know.
However,
I thought yuppies were in there somewhere.
No. Yankees. That's Yankees. All Yankees.
There we go.
And back much earlier, a local resident told me that Cary didn't always stand for that. Cary stood for can't afford Raleigh yet.
Not bad.
Which I thought was really cool. I was like, I like that. It's very cool. So, yes. Yeah. He said, yeah, we used to say that because, you know, Cary was in the country. And that's funny because it was. And when Cary was, and another thing I learned from one of the residents that I interviewed, it was when Cary was founded in 1871, it was 1 square mile. And that is where the Cary proper is today in downtown by the railroad. It's now 55 square miles. That's how much it's grown since then. But if you lived more than a half mile outside of Cary, you were considered a country person and living in the country.
That's probably where the country was.
I know they've tried to swallow Apex a few times, but the Apexians wouldn't let them.
That's right.
Because I know being around here, even as recently as 40 years ago, if you went west on Franklin Street, you know, you'd end up nowhere. I mean, there was just nothing out there.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. Now they're everywhere. I'm going to do a quick PSA so I can do my part.
Yes.
On March 22nd, which is tonight, I have that's right, it is, 2011, of course, at 7 p.m. in the Carborough Town Hall, there will be a public hearing on the rezoning application for a parcel of land in downtown Carborough for use as the site for the Southwest Branch Library, someplace she can go to do more research.
Yes.
It is the intent of the Board of County Commissioners to develop this property and move forward with the long-awaited goal of a freestanding full-service library to serve the citizens of Carborough and Southwest Orange County. All interested residents are encouraged to attend this meeting with representatives from Orange County to learn more about the project. Additional information is available. I'll get there. Moonshine's kicking in. Is available by calling Gwendolyn Harvey, Assistant County Manager, at 919-245-2307 or visiting www.co.orange.nc.us/library and so on. And that's the word we need to get out.
Get out there tonight. And, you know, the station is not taking sides, but I'm saying support your library.
Claim the library so Sherry can have another place to research.
Exactly. Libraries are great.
Yeah. We currently have the Carborough Branch Library sharing a McDougal middle school here, and it's, you know, restricted in its hours, and then it has a library here at the Carborough Century Center, and that has different hours. So this project will put everything together and allow the library services to expand, and they've been working more than 20 years to get a freestanding library.
Wow.
Goodness. And so, obviously you've been in support of it for a long time.
Well, a lot of other people have been working a long time. I've just been trying to get the word out recently. It's like, you know, yes, you can go there and express both sides of, but get out there, everybody.
Absolutely.
Anyway, 7 o'clock tonight, Town Hall, Carborough.
And that was Carborough, and now we're back to Cary. The latest book by Sherry Monahan. Or are we still there? Where are we now?
Well,
what's the next book?
The next book. Evelyn.
Let's plug this one once more. Give us your website so they'll know where to get this and the stores they can find it in.
This one is Images of America, Cary.
She's also got a book on Apex.
On Apex, if you're interested in Apex history. And you can go to my website. It's sherrymonahan.com, SHERRYMONAHAN.com.
Just like the bottle.
You said that, not me.
I did.
There's also information about my Western books out there, genealogy, anything you want to know about, you can go to that site and you know, email contact too as well.
All right. So with your energy, and I know you've got a lot of things going right now, but I'm sure, or I suspect, that you've got other plans.
I do. I have too many ideas. Too many.
Nonstop, yes.
That's the curse and the blessing of being an author is that you're working, and I write nonfiction, and I'll be working on a project, and all of a sudden, boom, oh, I have this great idea. Wait a minute, you're in the middle of this project. You can't possibly. So what I do is I'll stop, and I'll go out to a Word document, and I will quickly document, maybe just get like a page of that passion, because when you get that passion, you have to document it, because you may have the idea and you may still be passionate about the subject, but you can't capture that instant inspiration again.
No, you're
so
right.
When I get that inspiration, I will literally I write up a document, and I just, that passion is there, the inspiration is there. So when I go back to it, well, that sounded like a great idea, but why did I say I wanted to do that? And I read that and go, oh, that's why I got that idea.
when she passes on, she's going to wind up on the recharge pile. I can just see that.
Well, I do have another project in addition to my Evelyn. I call it my Evelyn book because that's how I met her. Her name is Evelyn in her journal. Right. So I always refer to it as Evelyn.
It's Ethel.
It's Ethel. Exactly. But another thing that I thought about, which would kind of be interesting, is I love history, obviously, and I love old photographs. And I can't tell you, I love antique stores. There's a surprise. I go into an antique store, and I always sort of gravitate to the box or the bin of the old photographs. Mm-hmm. You know, the Victorian portraits, the Civil War portraits of just people being posed. Mm-hmm. And I always look at those boxes, and I go, wow, that's so sad. Here are these people. They once had lives like I do, and they don't have anybody that cares about them anymore. You know, they're at some point their generation stopped and their photos were discarded to an antique person, and they're there. And my husband always says, well, if you don't like your current family, you can always make up a new one. Me, on the other hand, I go, oh, these poor people. And so, and I especially look for pictures that were taken out west. You know, if I see the photographer is Denver, Colorado, I found one from Deadwood, South Dakota, I'll buy that just because of that western connection.
Where are you from originally?
I grew up in New Jersey. I was born in Illinois. I grew up in New Jersey, and I've been here 22 years.
Here being
in North Carolina.
Okay,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
So,
and my parents are from upstate New York, so I'm all over the place.
She started out in Ray Bradbury country, and that's sort of what explains, I think.
The West is in my heart and my soul. How's that? Okay, it's my spirit.
Because you were once upon a time in some previous life in Tombstone.
I can tell you this, and I'm sure people are getting sick of me saying this, but I went to high school in New Jersey. In my high school class picture, I am the only person in a cowboy hat and cowboy boots.
So
it's his destiny.
It's funny you should say that. My mother had a picture of me that I didn't even know about. I found it in a photo album recently. I was born out of wedlock. She was in her 20s. And there's a picture. I couldn't have been more than 4 years old. And she's got me in an old seafarer's jacket, a coat, seafarer's coat, long before I ever went to sea.
See, it's what you, it's just kind of there.
Yes.
Right.
So I've been collecting these photographs. And one day I was working on the Carrie book, and I was on a deadline. And it's like, I got a deadline, and boom, here goes this idea. What if I collected all these photographs, and I made up personas for these people? Well, first, if there's any detail on the photo, a name or some kind of a clue in a town, I'll do genealogy on them and see if I can find out who they were. And if I can't, I'm going to make up a persona for them. At least their picture will be in a published book for all the world to see for eternity. May not be their real person, but at least their photo's there. And maybe, with any luck, someone will be able to identify that photo.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, it's sort of like a science fiction mystery kind of a book. You know, a fictional story, but with real photographs. And then I got to thinking, oh, well, you know, steampunk is really big right now.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm kind of into steampunk, not over the top like my good friend is, but I just think it's kind of cool. And I thought, what if I make myself into this story where, as an author, you know, I'm doing all my research and I come across these photographs and I buy this really awesome magnifying glass that helps me look at these pictures. But this magnifying glass, when I hold it, has special powers and lets me see. And these people tell me their history. And
that's
so that's kind of my idea.
Sounds like Harry Potter.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Kind of. But, you know, just sort of me as an author going through all this. And I've got all these great pictures. So I'm hoping that I can turn that into a really cool book and in a whole series as I'm finding more pictures. And if people end up wanting to send me pictures that they've collected or want me to add their family and make up a persona, I can do that. And so I just thought that'd be kind of fun.
I want to clue you into the fact that we have a steampunk show.
I know.
You know.
My crazy friend who, Michelle Black, she writes Victorian fictional books, awesome books. And she's got a new steampunk. I sent her that link. She was very excited about it.
Okay.
I'm not even sure I know what steampunk is.
Well, it combines Victorian dress, Victorian manners with machinery somehow.
Interesting. Okay.
Gadgets.
Sort of
gadgets.
Like another new wave.
Well, it's kind of like if you had, you know, things that were made in the Victorian time but have really cool futuristic capabilities.
Ah, okay, okay.
Think of the movie Wild Wild West or the TV show Wild West. The movie Wild Wild West.
Gotcha.
Right. And it's a whole genre. Music
it is.
Else.
Huge following.
Yes.
Becoming very, very popular.
Well, I'm going to have to put a stop to this.
Oh. And it's been so much fun.
Yeah. Not allowed to have that much fun.
I see John Paul is waiting in the wings, and we usually sort of cut out 5 minutes early to be gracious, give everybody enough time. And if, I'm not going to wait 2 years to have you on again. I could have gone on for another hour easily, but there's more to talk about.
I want that book. I want Evelyn. I want Tombstone,
so
Taste of Tombstone. So
that was actually how we got to the idea of you and I writing something together.
That's right.
That's fictional, and I've got 3 paragraphs, so we'll see if we can take that.
Is that inspiration?
But I've been working on other novels as well, so yes.
I get that.
I just wanted to do the opening scene. I've got the opening scene. At some point, I'll run it by you. We'll meet for coffee or something.
That sounds great.
Read it to you.
Oh, you know, I should have told you guys, too, real quickly. I also have a column that I write every month for True West Magazine.
That's right, yeah.
And it's called Frontier Fare, and every month features a recipe from the Old West and a story about it. So you can just go to my website. There's a link on that, too, for that. Or you can go to truewestmagazine.com.
That's sherrymonahan.com as well. And if you forget everything, it's claudio@claudioarts.com.
Yes.
Yes.
That's right.
Okay.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun,
absolute
as usual.
Pleasure.
Yeah.
And I would apologize for the high voltage energy that's been coming at you, but I'm not sure how to go about that, so I won't.
Well, no apologies. It's
no,
gift.
It's not.
It's
exactly.
A gift. We woke you up, people.
So thank you for tuning us in, and until next time, this is Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater signing off. Cheers.